In a culture that relentlessly promotes avarice and excess as the good life, a person happy doing his own work is usually considered an eccentric, if not a subversive. Ambition is only understood if it's to rise to the top of some imaginary ladder of success. Someone who takes an undemanding job because it affords him the time to pursue his own interests and activities is considered a flake. A person who abandons a career in order to stay home and raise children is considered not to be living up to his potential, as if a job title and salary are the sole measure of human worth. You'll be told in 100 ways, some subtle and some not, to keep climbing and never be satisfied with where you are, who you are, and what you're doing. There are a million ways to sell yourself out, and I guarantee you'll hear about them. To invent your own life's meaning is not easy, but it's still allowed, and I think you'll be happier for the trouble. Bill Watterson. So it's spring.
That's what I heard.
It's Easter, so it must be, but despite the cold and snow, this is the season of hope, regrowth, renewal, and redemption. It inspires optimism, energy, and fresh beginnings. Lo, the earth awakes again. But I am not an optimist. I was in my youth, but I seem to have outgrown it. I don't think I'm really a pessimist either, though. My position is more nuanced, more adult than that. I am well aware of the darkness as well as the light, of the fundamental pig-headedness of humankind, as well as the redeeming qualities that allow our species to survive. In the process of research for this talk, it came to my attention that there are now people in this country who are not old enough to remember Bill Watterson's wonderful Calvin and Hobbes comic. It was a phenomenon that lasted only 10 years, from November 1985 to December 1995. Its artistry was unparalleled, and its humor was quirky, occasionally surreal, and frequently quite deep. I imagine that there are people here today who expect this talk to be about them. But those of you who know me better will not be surprised that it's also about the moral and political philosophers they were named after. John Calvin, who was born in France and later fled to Switzerland, and Thomas Hobbes, an Englishman. I was curious as to why Watterson might have named these sweet and humorous characters after two of the gloomiest pessimists of the 16th century, and out of that curiosity came this talk. The 16th century was the peak of the Renaissance, a hopeful time if there ever was one. Since Rome had pretty much lost its monopoly on religion, politics, and scholarship, there was a lot of serious thinking going on all over Europe and even in its colonies. Then, as now, the nature of humankind, the nature of society, and the nature of God were constant and hotly debated topics. Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses in 1517 when Calvin was 8 years old. Coincidentally, about the age of Watterson's Calvin. We're going to call them J. Calvin and Calvin W. for the sake of confusion abatement. He, J. Calvin, was trained as a lawyer, but was a tireless writer of strong opinions in a great many topics, including religion. He broke with the Catholic Church in 1530 just in time for a growing violent uprising against Protestantism by the French public. After having seen the grand display of human nature brought upon by that conflict, he fled to Switzerland. Calvin believed in original sin and in the hopeless sinfulness and utter depravity of mankind. As he saw it, everything from the beginning of time was predetermined by God. Every person's damnation or salvation was established before their birth, and there was nothing that they could do about it. Christ had ensured salvation for some, a very few, but those had been chosen in advance, and no good works or fervent piety could save the rest. Thomas Hobbes was an Englishman born in Ireland 24 years after Calvin's death. By that time, Calvin's religious and philosophical ideas had become major forces in world, read European, society. And England was sorely afflicted. Although Hobbes was well enough placed in society to live quite comfortably, his family life and the interesting times in which he lived seem to have led him to a jaundiced view of human nature, on which he wrote frequently and at great length. His most famous statement is the one read earlier about life being solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. He also theorized about the social contract, but his version of it assumed that force was an absolute requirement and that the power that protected people from each other must be an absolute sovereign power that combines religious, civil, military, and judicial functions. His second most famous quote is, "The condition of man is a condition of war of everyone against everyone." In his view, human beings were naturally selfish, unprincipled, and incapable of getting along. Neither of these men are counted among the great Renaissance thinkers that we claim as precursors to Unitarian Universalism, but both have deep influence on our contemporary lives. Consider some of the popular assumptions in today's politics, that the natural concern of people is only self-interest and the acquisition of property, that dire punishment for transgressions is necessary to control public behavior, that the poor are morally deficient and that poverty is their natural state and they do not deserve to be helped, that dog-eat-dog commerce and politics are natural and unchallengeable, and that God made humans to be unredeemable, vile creatures. Of course, there were a few brighter lights, such as Michael Servetus, who we do count as a precursor of union. Servetus was a Spaniard who rejected the ideas of original sin and predestination and believed that Jesus was not an aspect of God, but a separate entity, both human and divine. He believed that other human beings, touched by Christian grace, could overcome sin and themselves be progressively divine. And incidentally, that the devil had created the papacy and as an effective countermeasure to Christ's coming to earth. He carried on a long argumentative correspondence with Calvin and eventually ticked Calvin off by sending him a copy of one of Calvin's own books, heavily annotated with arguments pointing to errors in his thinking. When Servetus came to Geneva, Calvin denounced him to the Inquisition, and Servetus was burned at the stake. Not exactly UU-approved behavior. So what is to Watterson's Calvin and Tiger Hobbes. Calvin is raw human nature in its natural form. Hobbes, as a non-human, provides an outsider's political and philosophical commentary on that nature. For instance, as J. Calvin described, Calvin W. is self-indulgent, self-centered, and unremorseful. So self-centered. The world would be a better place if people would stop thinking about themselves and focus on others for a change. Illegible. Oh, gee, I wonder who that might apply to. Me! Everyone should focus more on me! If heaven is good and I like to be bad, how am I supposed to be happy there? How will you get to heaven if you like to be bad? Let's say I didn't do what I wanted to do. Suppose I led a blameless life. Suppose I denied my true dark nature. I'm not sure I have that much imagination. Maybe heaven is a place where you're allowed to be bad. Mom and Dad say I should make my life an example of the principles I believe in. But every time I do, they tell me to stop it. I'm not sure that total self-indulgence is really a principle. He knows he's bad, but he's completely okay with that. And let me get out in front, and then I can read them. Calvin says, "It all boils down to luck, Hobbes. Some people are born lucky, and some people are born unlucky. Either way, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't fight luck." And Hobbes says, "We're headed for that cliff." Calvin says, "Yikes, bad luck." See what I mean? You go along minding your own business, and suddenly your luck runs out. If you're unlucky, what can you do? Ow, you're condemned to suffer. Ow. And Hobbes says, "Ooh, right in the pricker bushes, just like yesterday." Calvin says, "Maybe my luck will change tomorrow." He takes no responsibility for his actions. He controls his nature only under coercion. Calvin is putting up a sign which says, "Santa, weighed down with extra toys, drop them off here." He says, "Now we need to get this on the roof. I've been thinking, they say Santa knows if you've been bad or good, right?" "Right." "But think how many kids there are in the whole world. Nobody could be watching every kid every single minute. I mean, Santa's old. He probably even takes naps." "The way I figure it, Santa must just make a few random checks on us once or twice a week." "That's all?" "Sure, he'd catch enough bad kids that way to scare everybody else into being good. Most of the time, he'd create the impression that he's watching more than he really is." Hobbes says, "Pretty shrewd." "Yeah, but now that I'm onto him, I'm going to go smack Susie with a snowball. If I do it quick, the odds of Santa watching me at that exact moment are virtually nil." And Hobbes says, "But what if Susie tells on you?" He says, I didn't think of that. She's a girl, so she probably would snitch. Fooey. Well, I sure hope Santa's watching now, seeing as I'm being so good. Bob says, unwillingly good, but good nonetheless. He apparently believes in predestination. Therefore, he doesn't learn much from experience. Hobbes, on the other hand, has his own point of view, which may not recognize Calvin as the center of their universe. Calvin says, I don't understand this business about death. If we're just going to die, what's the point of living? And they both think for a moment. And Hobbes says, well, there's seafood. Calvin says, I don't know why I even talked to you before dinner. Hobbes is just along for the ride. He's a stuffed animal, so he views the world as a passive observer and sometimes points out the obvious. Calvin says, I have a question. Do you believe in life after death? You know, reincarnation? And Hobbes, covering his eyes, says, you just steer, okay? Hobbes lives more in the moment, in contrast with Calvin's forceful struggle with ideas and reality. Calvin says, what if there's no afterlife? Suppose this is all we get. Hobbes looks around, says, oh, what the heck, I'll take it anyway. Calvin says, yeah, but if I'm not going to be eternally rewarded for my behavior, I'd sure like to know now. And of course, he's a great straight man. Calvin says, I used to hate writing assignments, but now I enjoy them. I realize that the purpose of writing is to inflate weak ideas, obscure poor reasoning, and inhibit clarity. With a little practice, writing can be intimidating and impenetrable fog. I want to see my book report? And Hobbes reads, the dynamics of interbeing and monological imperatives in Dick and Jane, a study in psychic transrelational gender modes. Calvin says, academia, here I come. But somehow, despite his nature, Calvin W. fails to reach the depths of evil and the depravity that J. Calvin might have expected. And despite his apparent free-range upbringing, he doesn't seem to have a real dog-eat-dog competitiveness. He's an innocent, totally lacking in malice, and really damaging only to himself, the wagon, and possibly his teacher. Seen from a less Calvinist, more UU perspective, he actually seems redeemable. Calvin says, today at school I tried to decide whether to cheat on my test or not. I wondered, is it better to do the right thing and fail, or is it better to do the wrong thing and succeed? On one hand, undeserved success gives no satisfaction, but on the other hand, well-deserved failure gives no satisfaction either. Of course, most everybody cheats sometime or other. People always bend the rules if they think they can get away with it. Then again, that doesn't justify my cheating. Then I thought, look, cheating on one little test isn't such a big deal. It doesn't hurt anyone. But then I wondered if I was just rationalizing my unwillingness to accept the consequences of not studying. Still, in the real world, people care about success, not principles. And then again, maybe that's why the world is such a mess. What a dilemma. Hobbes says, so what did you decide? He said, nothing. I ran out of time and had to turn in a blank paper. And Hobbes says, anymore, simply acknowledging the issue is a moral victory. And Calvin says, well, it just seemed wrong to cheat on an ethics test. Although his behavior is very self-centered, he is, after all, only a small boy, and he balances it with sincere thoughtfulness. Oops, I lost a slide there. So although Calvin, J. Calvin would have considered Calvin W. to be beyond redemption, I think that I would assume that he was redeemable partly for the same reasons that J would condemn him. I find that it's useful when I'm wise enough to manage it, to assume that most people are trying without malice to make things come out for the best. This assumption may not be valid. After all, there are Hobbesians all around us. But making it allows me to negotiate in good faith, just in case I can engage the kinder, gentler part of someone else's nature. Sometimes one gets messed up that way, but I would rather be disappointed than live in the assumption of malice. Besides, sometimes it works. So Mo, the bully, says, look, Calvin's got a teddy bear. That's real sweet, Cal. And Calvin says, it's a tiger, you brainless invertebrate. Mo says, hey, maybe I'd like to play with your teddy. And Calvin says, good idea, Mo. Hobbes plays kind of rough, but he's lots of fun. Come here and take him. And Mo says, why? Is the teacher watching? This is a trick, right? I'm not touching your stupid teddy, see? And Calvin says, come on, I dare you. What's the matter? Are you chicken? And then he says to Hobbes afterwards, ha ha, boy, you sure scared him off. You were great. And Hobbes says, come back and call me a bear again. Yay, you bub. So now, on Easter, if we're looking for hope and redemption, I think we could do worse than to read Calvin and Hobbes. Above all things, the cartoon is about love. There's the love between Calvin and Hobbes themselves, but there's also the influence of his remarkably tolerant parents, and Calvin's intense and wonderful small boy joy in life. Above all, there's the clear, deep lovingness of their creator, Bill Watterson, who shows them to us with indulgent tolerance. I believe that in such love is our redemption. This was the last cartoon. Says, wow, it really snowed last night. Isn't it wonderful? Everything familiar has disappeared. The world looks brand new. And Calvin says, a new year, a fresh clean start. Hobbes says, it's like having a big white sheet of paper to draw on. Calvin says, a day full of possibilities. It's a magical world, old buddy. Let's go exploring. It snowed last night. It's not a new year, but it is a new spring. It's coming more slowly than we might like, but it's coming nevertheless. It's a season of hope and renewal. May we enter it with love. Happy Easter.
Thank you. So it's a custom of our congregation to have a response time. Does anybody have